Cystic fibrosis is a genetic disease. Mucus fills up your lungs and you have a hard time breathing. And that's just one of the many symptoms over your whole body. I'm Barrett Golding. This is Hearing Voices from NPR. This next hour, we'll hear from people living with cystic fibrosis. First up, Laura Rothenberg. Producer Joe Richman of Radio Diaries gave her an audio tape recorder. She spent the next 2 years documenting her life. The story, My So-Called Lungs, aired in 2002 when Laura was 21.
Hi, this is Laura. It's about 11:02 p.m. I'm here in the hospital. I've been here for 5 days now. I'm in room 1004 this time. That's me coughing. Hello.
Hi.
This is Karina. She's one of my favorite nurses. Yeah, we can put that. I have a sort of status in the hospital. They don't even say my last name. It's like, oh, Laura's coming in. You know, I've seen patients come and go, and I've seen nurses come and go. I've seen medical students become interns, become attendings. It's like my hotel. Okay, Karina's gonna stick me 22 3/4 needle. In we go. I don't feel a thing. Ooh, that hurts. I don't have to be on death's door to go into the hospital. We got a blood return. Now we're flushing it. Nice blood return. Now we're flushing. They call them tune-ups. It's almost like you charge the battery on your cell phone. And now we're going to hook me up back to my antibiotics. Yeah, that was quick, easy, no pain. Phew!
I'll be back.
Thanks. Get back into bed here. My nice, comfy electric bed. I was diagnosed with cystic fibrosis when I was 3 days old. It was 1981, and I guess at that time, my parents really didn't know how long I would end up living. The average lifespan of a person with CF was much younger than it is now. When I was 12 and 13, I met a lot of kids in the hospital with CF. There was sort of like a whole gang, you know, there were all the CF kids. And we just play cards and talk dirt about the nurses and watch TV shows at night, ride down the hall on IV poles. There was just this sort of bond, you know. Gina died when we were 13. Damien died that year, he was 17. Nikki Cooley died, Talmisha died, Elizabeth Florin died winter of 12th grade. My friend Sophie died when I was in 11th grade. She was one of my best friends with CF. And my friend Marcy died this past summer. Do you hear how quiet it is? This is the sort of after hours. Calm. Everyone's asleep. I like nights in the hospital. Good night. This is Laura, back again. Dad and I are on the Bruckner. We're driving up to Providence. I agreed to let him drive. I just spent about 4 or 5 days in the hospital again for a partial bowel obstruction, so that was thrilling as ever, and luckily it was only a partial obstruction, so they were really excited about that. Of course, at the moment, I wasn't as excited because I had a tube in my butt, and it's a little bit hard to be excited when you have a tube in your butt. Wouldn't you say, Dad? Why are you crying?
Well, I mean, it's hard to talk about this, you know, not knowing what's going to happen next, and you go ahead with your life as best you can. Pause it for a second.
So, now for a little lesson. Here's the deal with CF. Basically, your body produces abnormally thick, sticky mucus that resides in the lungs. And the lungs are sort of the deadly part of the disease in that after years of infection, the lungs sort of get worn away and deteriorate. Most people who see me on the street wouldn't realize how much harder I work to breathe, or even people who know me don't really realize it, because over the years I've got better and better at sort of hiding the fact that I have trouble breathing. It's funny, sometimes I cough so hard that I can see stars. So I'm back here at Brown. Classes started on Wednesday.
Take care. Yeah, thanks. Good to see you.
I think that people who know me, who really know me, who are my friends, don't see me as someone who is sick. They see me as Laura, you know, who's a sophomore at Brown, and it's hard for them to imagine, you know, oh, she might not be here in a few years. They know I have CF. They know that it means that you get very sick and that you die. But they see me, and it's hard for them to make it real, because they don't want to, because no one wants to, because, you know, they want me to live forever because I'm their friend. The truth is that even though I'm always thinking about health-related stuff, I don't want to come off as someone who's purely thinking about health-related stuff. I think that's kind of boring.
I'm actually wearing my oxygen just because it's easier for me to breathe with this on. So that's why I'm wearing the oxygen. I'm not feeling very well. The past week, I get into these really bad coughing fits, and I just have trouble, you know, walking, just feeling kind of tired. I don't know, it's frustrating. And even though people say that it's supposed to get so much worse, I don't quite understand how I'm expected to just watch it get worse. Like this is not okay, the fact that I'm in on a Friday night. I mean, I'm in college, I'm 19. I should have gone to this play I was supposed to go to. I should have gone to these two parties I was invited to. But instead I'm here. It's just frustrating. I want to be like my peers. But I don't know how. Anyway. I think I'm going to go to bed.
Hi. It's a couple days after my birthday, so I'm 20. It just sort of all hit me today. I was lying on the couch in the living room, and the sun was setting. And I just knew it. And it was at that moment that I really felt that I wouldn't be alive at New Year's. The last few weeks, I definitely have felt that I was starting the dying process. And it's just a matter of when, how fast, how much at a time. It didn't make sense to push the limit, try to see how long I could last with these old lungs. So I decided I'm going to try the lung transplant. You know, there are risks with it. The obvious one, of course, being if it doesn't go well and I die. But I didn't want to just go downhill without trying to stop it first.
Wait, where is she right now? Wait, so we're waiting till she takes the box off and then we're saying surprise? Yeah. Okay.
Surprise! Hello!
All my friends came to this lung retirement party.
We are gathered here this evening just to send Laura off with a hurrah as she leaves Brown temporarily as a student.
Well, I've decided to leave college and go up to Boston. That's where the hospital is, and wait there for my transplant. I have the poster that my friend designed that says, "Thank you to the lungs of Laura for 20 years of exemplary service." So that's kind of neat.
Well, that's a wrap.
Hello? Julie? Hi. Yeah, I haven't talked to you in a long time. Oh, it's okay. You know, I'm sort of just sitting here waiting for lungs. Yeah, but they've had what they're calling a lung drought. You know, there's nothing I can do to make it happen. You know, short of going out and hitting someone with a car. Yeah. I do. Okay. I'll talk to you soon. Love you. Bye. Mom? Mom? My dad and my mom are very worried. They wish they could do something, but we don't spend a lot of time talking about it.
I remember, even when you were younger, before even the question of the transplant came up, I watched you, you know, go through this. I watched you get very ill. Still, I have never really been able to experience what you've been experiencing, and at times, you know, had no idea what you were going through.
I remember that we were always wondering about how to talk with you about what the disease meant, and it never seemed to be the right moment with any particular reason to throw this at you. And then there was this particular time when there was something on the news about cystic fibrosis, and you were
I was 11
and Hi. You told me that the dad, this will probably be in the paper tomorrow, and why don't you cut it out for me and I'll read it on the school bus. So I went to the paper, and exactly what I feared had happened. In the last sentence it said, cystic fibrosis, the most common genetic disease, and the average life expectancy is 18 years or 21 years or whatever it was. So I thought, I can't have my daughter read this on the school bus, go on the school bus and read this, that she's going to die at an early age like this, because by now you would understand what it meant. And so I thought to myself, I've got 10 minutes to tell my daughter she's going to die. And I went in the kitchen.
And I was sitting there eating.
You were having your Cheerios. And
right.
I said to you, Laura, you know this illness you have, the cystic fibrosis, it's a serious illness. And such was the tone in my voice that you kind of got it immediately, and you became very tremulous, and you said, you mean I'm going to die? And when you said it in that tone of voice, I completely broke down, and I was crying, and I said to you, which was true, that it's my dream that you should outlive me. And at this point, it was really remarkable. You were, put her arm around me and began to comfort me. I got a phone call that afternoon that said, "Dad, that article, the point of that article is that there's hope, isn't it? Isn't that what the point is?" And I said, "Yes, Laura, that's the point of it." So.
I remember that conversation.
You reached Laura. The news this 15th of July is that Laura is today having her lung transplant.
Well, it's about 10 to 8 in the morning. I'm here in the hospital. The sun has just come up, and the animal curtains are pulled across my window, but there's just a little bit of light showing through into my room, and it's shining on my toes.
Hi there. Maybe if I get you upstairs.
You know, this surgery is going to happen, and it's weird. When I go in the OR, I always like to look at all the monitors when I'm lying on the table and all the faces and the lights. Lights are really bright. There's sort of this feeling of once the anesthetic is in, everything's sort of hazing out, forcing you to close your eyes. And I always try to keep my eyes open as long as I possibly can to remember the last moment that I was awake. And it's so hard to do that. It always wins out.
Hi, my name is Lauren. I'm a friend of Laura Rothenberg's. She came out of the surgery well last night. She has beautiful new lungs, and more updates will come. All right, bye-bye.
That sound. Those were my new lungs. And this is a picture. It's in the OR, and they're taking the lungs out of the ice, and it's a close-up, and it's in like a metal basin type thing. It's my lungs. Up close, it just looks like a turkey, basically.
Bye, thank you. Good luck with everything. Thanks.
I'm leaving the hospital after 19 days, and it's very exciting. Most people ask, how does it feel? Like, how does it feel different to breathe? And it's funny because it feels like a completely different body. Sort of everything about it seems new. I don't know it like I knew my body before. It's like a whole new ball game. This is Laura, and I'm sitting here with my cat, Gus, who's asleep. I haven't talked in a while. On Monday, it'll be a year since my lung transplant. So I'm happy I've made it a year. But it was not the year that I dreamed of. Complication after surgery after surgery and rejection and lymphoma. I've had to get a feeding tube put back in because I've lost so much weight. You know, I think to get to the transplant, I really had to pretend that the transplant would do more than it realistically could do for me. My whole life, I've been searching for something to fix me. And it hasn't. I definitely think about after I'm gone. I've always been scared that people will forget about me. But I'm also here right now. So it's about trying to come to a place where I can just accept that things have gone the way they've gone and accept that it's never going to be perfect. You know, I'm well enough to go back to school. I'll be a junior. You know, I want to walk from my dorm to the main green, maybe even play soccer, which I haven't done for like 8 years. No. But I don't really count on anything anymore. I just go with the flow. I think that's okay.
My So-Called Lungs first aired in 2002. It was reported by Laura Rothenberg, edited by Deborah George, and produced by Joe Richman for RadioDiaries.org, with support from the Open Society Institute and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Laura Rothenberg died March 2003. A few months later, her memoir was published. It's called Breathing for a Living. Coming up, we have audio diaries from two more CF patients. One wants a lung transplant, the other doesn't. That's in a minute on Hearing Voices.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
This is Hearing Voices. Producer Katie Tularski of Connecticut Public Radio spent a year recording two people living with cystic fibrosis, Brian Circus and Beth Peters. This is their story of four failing lungs.
Hey, it's me. It's Tuesday, I think the 22nd of June. I had my second call for transplant that didn't go through. Another donor was meant to get the lungs. I found out today that actually he didn't, because the lungs threw a clot, a blood clot, and they couldn't be used at all. I just tried to recover from the journey last night of thinking maybe I was getting my lungs, and then I didn't. I'm starting to crack under the pressure, but I'm tired. Tired of waiting and tired physically.
I was talking to my friend with CF who has decided to get a transplant. She's on the list and she's waiting. It could be any day now. I was talking to her and telling her how excited I am for her and how great it's going to be for her. She started expressing how she felt bad for me because I wasn't getting a transplant. Just kind of made me think, like, a lot of people think that if you don't get a transplant, you're just kind of resigning to die. And it's not the case. It's the opposite. I want to live. I want to do everything I can with the time that I have, however much time that may be. I'm Brian Circus. 28 years old. Nope. 29. With CF, cystic fibrosis.
I'm Mary Elizabeth Peters. I'm 29 years old. I'm a drama teacher and a poet. When I was born with cystic fibrosis, kids lived till about 8 or 10 years old. So being my age and the other CF patients that are my age have had this kind of unique experience of kind of chasing the demographic. You know, now that I'm 29, the average mortality is around 37. I grew up always thinking, oh, I'm only going to live to be 10. Oh, I'm only going to live to be 15.
I was diagnosed when I was 3. And I was really healthy up until about 22. And since then, there's a pretty sharp decline over the next, like, 5 years or so.
My lung capacity kind of was falling away from me in a very slow way as I was growing up and through college. I was having, you know, a little bit of sickness here, a little bit of sickness there. So then by the time I was in my early 20s, I was down to about 40% lung capacity. The lung function that I'm at right now is about 19%.
Last year, I got really sick. You know, they were surprised that I recovered. And it's been a slow recovery. I had to move back home from Boston.
You know, in many ways, college is, you know, you have all this free time. And then you move into the work world, and you have to be somewhere every day at a certain time and be there for 8, 9, 10 hours. And it gets more difficult to figure out, well, how am I going to do 3 treatments a day? How am I going to get enough sleep?
Well, what do I miss about Boston? I mean, all my friends. I really miss them. I miss the independence. I miss Fenway. I miss going to the park. I miss driving. When I was in the ICU and my lungs were failing, the doctors were talking to me and my family about me dying and all the things we needed to do to prepare for that. And then just, I don't know, just kind of out of the blue, I started getting better. Still don't really understand why. Presumably all of the drugs they were pumping into me. So anything would have been better than, you know, dying. But no, I, you know, went through rehab. It was crazy. I know. Right, Lily? Yeah.
My name is Ahmed Euler, director of the Adult Cystic Fibrosis Program at the Combined Children's Hospital Boston and Brigham and Women's CF Center. Beth and Brian were part of our CF Center. Cystic fibrosis is a genetically transmitted disease, and it impacts about 30,000 people in the U.S.
There's a deficiency in it's called the CFTR
gene, or the cystic fibrosis transmembrane regulator gene, which leads to dysfunction in multiple organs. It predominantly affects the lung. And in the lungs, when you have a dysfunctioning protein, you end up having a dehydrated airway surface liquid layer. This simple abnormality where chloride is not being regulated properly at the cell surface essentially doesn't allow for bacteria and other debris to be cleared. It also is very hospitable to bacteria.
Bacteria can thrive. So bacteria that are normally pretty harmless to regular people will become very dangerous.
Chronic infection and inflammation that slowly destroys the lung.
It is a disease affecting the endocrine system, so most people produce wet, slippery mucus.
Which is gross, right? I always say CF is the grossest disease anybody could have.
Thicker and, like, sticky mucus.
The mucus that's in your lungs, that's in your digestive system, in your gynecological system, instead of being thin and being used for its proper functions in different areas of the body, it is too thick. It kind of grabs germs and grabs diseases.
Very friendly to bacteria.
And keeps them and lets them grow.
And in the lungs, it just clogs up the airways, so eventually...
What we call an obstructive ventilatory defect.
You know, you just have a lot of trouble breathing.
You feel kind of like you're drowning all day.
Okay, it's just physical therapy. So what's happening is that the whole theory behind it is I'm pounding on his chest so that I can loosen all the thick mucus that he has more than you and I, and because he needs to cough it up. Because if he doesn't, that's when he gets the bad infection.
The light beating of your chest in different positions to drain the mucus and to open up the airways, literally beating yourself, like beating mucus out of yourself.
This is something that he has to have every single day. Coughing helps. Not everybody loves to cough. Because for them, when they start coughing, sometimes they can't stop coughing, or sometimes they cough so hard it makes them want to throw up.
When you cough up that big plug that you just, like, feel has been causing you trouble, and now it's gone, it's relieving, it's cathartic. And I was really healthy up until when I first started growing cepacia.
We usually say that there's no emergencies in CF, but this bacteria presents an emergency. A group of organisms that we know that cause a worsening disease in CF patients. In fact, when we use the word cepacia, it is patients feel this is a death sentence. They feel like this is the bacteria you need to avoid.
There was a time when it seemed like a lot of patients were contracting cepacia, and adult patients who were doing relatively well, and then getting cepacia, and then immediately having getting very sick very quickly from it.
These bacteria also impact the way you survive the post lung transplant,
because the cepacia can come back even after the lungs were taken out and replaced with new ones. And I think it's because the cepacia doesn't just get into the lungs, it gets into the blood, it gets into the whole body. Considering the life I'd have to live just to go through this, to have, you know, just a 50% chance of surviving, just didn't sound like a good decision for me. In the way I've lived my life. You know, I'd rather fizzle out, you know, than fade.
You know, many years ago, we used to have CF patients play together, go to camps together, and hang out together until we noticed that these bacteria were spreading more rampantly.
In the hospital, we had our own little CF crew, because it was just like kind of a steady rotation of us throughout the year. The nursing staff all knew us and loved us. Well, you know, knew us anyway. And we were just kids, and it was kind of like a second family.
And then now in adulthood, they don't want us to have any contact at all.
You know, as we got older, got sicker. My first friend died when I was, I think, 11 or 12.
I had a very close family friend who actually passed away when I was like 13 or 14.
You know, that's when I started like considering my own mortality.
What is my relationship with my lungs? I don't hate them. I feel like my lungs are like a really poorly behaved child. You know, that it's like my job to coax them and take care of them and rub them and hold them. But then sometimes they're really, really bad, and I get really angry at them and want to give them a timeout.
I don't want them anymore. I'm done with them. I wish I could break up with them.
Yeah. It's not my lungs. It's the stuff in my lungs. And I hate that stuff.
My biggest difficulties getting on the transplant list was facing the reality that part of my body would literally be removed. Thinking of all of those cells and parts of my body and my life's memory and journey taken out of me and then somebody else is put in, it was kind of hard for me to wrap my head around.
I mean, I would have no problem cutting them out of me. Like, I'm not attached to these other than them being attached to me.
It's been just a really difficult couple days. And people say that I have all this energy. And the truth is that I do have that energy. And then, like, one day a month, I lose my and cry all day. So I'm trying to, like, get out of that mindset. But I think it's actually good to just have a day where I just am like, this sucks, and I'm going to spend my whole year like this, and then I might not even make it. Which is kind of why I never really wanted a transplant, because I didn't want to spend the last year of my life like this, alone in my house, not accomplishing anything, or feeling that way. And then I might not make it anyway. You know, this is kind of where I'm at right now. Well, it was really difficult. I mean, I would say a year and a half ago, I wasn't even considering lung transplant because I've watched a lot of friends or family members go through it and have great difficulty or pass away rather quickly after their transplant. My thought was, I wouldn't want to die twice. You know, I wouldn't want to go through the whole process of preparing for death and then get a transplant and then a year later be dying again.
At that point when you're so sick that you're needing a transplant, or I should say at this point, a lot of times it's easy to feel like you don't have any control. And that's something I have control over is, you know, it's a decision I can make. It's firm. And also, you know, I kind of know how it's going to be at this point.
I get it that, you know, other people would say, if this is it, if this is how my life is ending, I don't want to spend that time being a lab rat.
You know, it's just a lot of soul searching, I guess you'd say. You know, a lot of questioning the ideas that are presented to me, and just, I think, asking the questions that everyone asks themselves, maybe just a decade earlier.
I mean, have we had so many false alarms that nobody's answering?
Record your message at the tone. When you are finished, hang up or hold for more options.
Hello, it's Beth. It's Beth. Call me back. Wait, I'm going to try one more time, and then I got to get on the road.
Hello?
Hi, Mom. I got a call.
I knew it.
As the primary recipient. But I got to get everything ready. Carl's here in my driveway, so I'm going to go, and then I'll call you at the hospital to give you more details.
Okay, you're at Boston?
Yeah, at Boston.
Okay, so, all right.
And it's a it's a young donor.
I knew it.
Okay.
Yes, I knew it. All right.
Okay.
All right, I know you're busy. Call me back.
Okay, I love you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hi, this is Beth Peters. I am a lung transplant recipient from July 27th, 2010. The third time I was called in was the time that I got my transplant. I was feeling really excited, and I was feeling
really, like, I just wanted to get it over with. Because the more time that went by, the more I started to think about the actual process of it. And that was making me very emotional. I call them boyfriend. Because I'm convinced that they're male. I don't know if the donor was male or not. But the things that they do are very masculine. Like, they burp all the time. They make me burp. I never burped before. I'm quite a lady. And now, all of a sudden, I'll burp all the time. Like a man. The weirdest sensation is that more than half the time when I cough, there's nothing, there's no, it's just like, that's it, you know? And I never had that experience before. To know that, like, normal people cough and clear their throat and they don't cough something up. Who knew? Well, I remember right after I got my transplant, I told my sister that my lungs felt like a big empty cave. And they still kind of feel that way because I can't feel everything. And before, I could feel every single thing that happened in my lungs. Like, if I had fluid here or bleeding there or whatever, I could feel everything. And now I can't really feel anything. So when I inhale, I can just keep inhaling, and it seems like I don't really know when it ends. So I kind of still think of them that way, as like a big empty cave.
You and I have a similar situation, like, kind of up until the transplant part of it.
How's it working out?
It's going pretty well. I mean, I had a pretty rocky road right after my surgery and was really, you know, pretty ill for about a month. And then from the point I got home, things have been getting back to normal with kind of a crazy speed. I can wake up in my bed and be in my car in like 20 minutes, like, which is what normal people do who are like about to be late to work. And I've never been able to do that before.
Frankly, it just makes me wish I didn't have sepatia. I mean, I would, I think I would transplant in a heartbeat if I didn't.
A few months ago, I had an episode of hemoptysis, which is coughing up blood. And I woke up in the middle of the night. I was like gargling, and I knew what it was. So I got up, because this has happened to me before. You know, it was just kind of spitting it out as it came up. But it kept coming up. And it kept coming, and I like couldn't breathe. And it suddenly occurred to me that this is probably how it's going to happen. This is what dying is going to feel like. Turning 30 for me was more of an accomplishment. My mom, being the wonderful person she is, threw me a huge, amazing birthday party and invited all of my friends from all over and family.
A lot's happened in the last couple of years, and you know, my life has changed a lot, and my opinions on certain things have changed, and I guess what I've come to the conclusion is that I'm going to pursue a lung transplant. Woo!
I want to say my gut told me, you know? But it's more than that.
It just feels like it's right.
Because I analyzed it a lot. My gut told me that it would be best for me to just take the time I had, and rather than, you know, chase some sort of pipe dream with this lung transplant, make the most of the time I had. Time with my friends, time with my family. Just kind of be happy for every day, you know? And I did that. I did that for 2 years. I did what I wanted to do. I did it. Then we go back to that day of me coughing blood. That was a turning point for me. That was when I started thinking,
you know what? Maybe I do want to try for a transplant. Like, whatever happens, happens. I'm not nervous about it failing. I actually get nervous thinking about what I'm going to do with myself after transplant. Like, am I going to have to go back to work? Really?
Some of the poems just kind of fly out of me. This poem in particular came because a woman called me a dragon slayer. And I thought, it really bothered me because I thought, I don't know, I just thought that's a weird personification of me. In the world of that, like a dragon slayer, humans, mythology, I would rather be the dragon because the dragon, you know, doesn't ever get slayed by the dragon slayer.
That's what this is really about. Dungeons and Dragons. It's a fantastic game where you can be anything. You can be anything you want. A warrior prince.
An outcast wizard of dark magic.
Hell, you could be an orc. Or a half-orc.
I am a dragon. I fly through the sky, though heavy with wings like steel, never tiring. I land upon the sea, perched on delicate feet, never sinking. I plunge to the deepest depth of the sea, never gasping. I do not need to breathe like you. I do not need to breathe.
You could be a monk. I had a good friend named Xanthar. He was a half-orc monk.
I am a green, white, pink, white, purple, white dragon. I float into the clouds and am invisible. I climb among trees and am a giant. I balance on the mountaintop only to witness. I do not need to rest like you. I do not need to rest.
A great gold worm dragon, WYRM.
I am a mythical, imaginary, remembered, and forgotten dragon. I do not fly among you, but I would. I may not fly forever, but I could. I will not fly in silence, though I should. I am not defeated by you. I am not defeated. I am a dragon. People with CF, they have to beat the odds. So some things happen and are unexplainable and kind of seem to have a magical quality to them. When, you know, if you grow up and people are telling you, oh, you're only going to live till you're 10, and then you're 10, you're only going to live till you're 15, and then you're 15, and then you're 25, and it goes on and on, it seems like there's a magical quality to it. You know, like, haha, joke's on you, you didn't get me.
I'm excited to get the transplant. I'm nervous that I won't get lungs in time. I'm anxious, but just kind of like, you know, going crazy wanting it.
Four Failing Lungs was produced by Katie Talarski and edited by John Dankowski of Connecticut Public Radio. The music was by Matt Costa, Mon Jacquet, Stars, and Diego Sousa. Brian Serkis died August 2011, a few weeks after this documentary was finished. He never got his new lungs. This is Hearing Voices. One of the longest surviving lung transplant recipients is Howell Graham. He had both lungs replaced in 1990.
I remember waking up from the surgery, being on the vent, and seeing this absolutely beautiful brunette nurse. She held my hand her entire shift, and, you know, I was kind of in and out of consciousness. And I guess the following shift, a male nurse came in, this big burly dude, and I was not happy at all. Couldn't talk because I was on the ventilator, but I just was writing notes like, get him the heck out of here, and I don't want this guy, get me the girl back, and
lots of cursing.
And my dad was tearing up the notes because he was scared the male nurse would find the notes and kill me, so he spent his time intercepting my hate notes,
which is kind of understandable. When did you get out of the hospital?
It was a month later.
And when you got home, things were going well, and you—
Well, things were going fantastic, and I'd been out in my dad's little 17-foot boat thinking I knew what I was doing, and I ended up jumping out of the boat. and the boat got away from me, and it's too far to swim, and I really thought I was going to drown.
6 months out of a double lung transplant.
6 months out of a double lung transplant, and the first thing that popped in my mind was Dr. Egan, who's kind of a little fireball, how mad he was going to be that he had given me this transplant, and I blew it just being stupid.
He said he would have killed me, and I said he would have had to get in line. Your father and I would have been the first in line to kill you for this. We worked 28 years. He worked 12 hours.
Yeah.
And so...
21 years later almost, that these are my lungs, and it's pretty amazing to have made it that far out. I've just been a lucky person.
Life is good.
Life is good.
Howell Graham and his mom, Nan, were recorded by the StoryCorps Project, StoryCorps.org. I'm Barrett Golding, and there's links to everything you heard this hour at HearingVoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of SoundImagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is HearingVoices.com.